Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Morality of Everyday Things. I'm Ant.
And I'm Jake.
And we're actually testing a new format here. So on the back of the feedback forms that we put out, one of the most consistent bits of feedback was we want to hear from you guys more often.
More regularly, more predictably.
The other thing was that people wanted to hear more of our genuine disagreements and thoughts. And so we kind of thought, the problem is we're such busy boys. We think we've come up with a format that will help us fill your longing for Ant and Jake time. We're gonna now try and release every other week or so a little hot take session where we discuss questions that listeners have sent in or things in the news that have recently caught our attention, starting with this week. This is actually something I'd posted about on LinkedIn. For those who don't know, I'm a bit of a big dog on the old adult social media network.
Ant describes himself as a LinkedIn influencer. Make of that what you will.
I'll have you know, I have had 30,000 impressions in the last 7 days on my LinkedIn.
Is that good?
I have no idea. In response to something that someone had posted about the refugee crisis in the UK and specifically the recent kerfuffle with Gary Lineker.
What did you put on LinkedIn then? What was your post?
Basically, someone had written about it and I wrote, I'll do it in more detail at the right point, but I basically wrote that I actually think it's so crazy that there's all of this fighting over taking refugees when actually it sounds, I mean, I know there's a cost at the moment, but like really it's, you know, in a post-Brexit world, we should be bringing more young people. And also I personally have the controversial opinion that like more developed European, North American countries, Latin American countries too, should actually be actively encouraging their population growth. We have stagnating populations. And from a purely international relations, kind of geopolitical safety perspective, I'm a little concerned, you know, what happens when the inevitable happens and China is like by far and away, you know, as their population will eventually make the case, the most economically powerful nation on the planet. And, you know, they're run by an authoritarian government who do not have concerns for human welfare.
I see. You're saying if they become a global superpower and we don't have the same humanitarian standards in place.
Yeah, I'm saying basically at the end of the day, population wins out, mm-hmm. right? And if there are countries that we're concerned, I'm sounding very xenophobic. I have no problem with the average Chinese person, obviously.
Yeah.
My problem is with the regime. But yeah, I mean, basically they're going to become more and more powerful by sheer weight of people, mm-hmm. right? And then at the same time, we have declining populations because we're sub-replacement rate. So replacement rate is about 2.1 per woman. I think in the UK, we're like 1.75 or something.
Yeah, I think I had 1.8 in my head. I don't know.
Also makes a pension crisis waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens when you have way more old people who aren't doing productive work? Again, another reason we should be welcoming young people.
Well, that's empirically the case for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But sorry, that was a little diatribe. It's in that context, I basically wrote something like, why are we not welcoming young people who are, you know, thankful to be, I mean, that sounds so entitled, but you know what I mean? Like, they're literally like, I am just glad to be somewhere I'm safe. Like, you know, we're like, oh, we can't fill jobs. And also, don't forget, a lot of refugees, sorry, I don't mean to stereotype, oh, low-skilled jobs, blah, blah, blah. A lot of refugees are high-skilled people who were fleeing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
who, like, have to give up everything. You know, I guess maybe the highest skilled were able to leave, you know, a little earlier and through conventional routes. But still, you're getting, like, you get mid-level people who are, like, by all means, like, overqualified for the type of jobs they'd come and do here. That's actually one of the things in labor economics I remember we studied. Generally, people kind of take a kind of downwards diagonal step in order to move to a more secure economy. That's pretty conventionally something that we found. Why are we not welcoming those people? That was a really long way of saying that's what I wrote.
Yeah, nice and succinct, mate. Well done.
Yeah.
It does sound like you kind of agree with, well, roughly agree with the opinions of Gary Lineker. For the avoidance of doubt and for being as clear as possible, I'll give you guys a quick run through of the timeline of what has been happening. If you haven't been following it in the news, if you have, I'll try and keep this short anyway, just so you're up to the same page as we are.
Wait, Jake. Since I spent so long faffing around it, should I just read the LinkedIn comment quickly?
Go on, yeah, do your post.
What I said was, someone had written about the whole crisis, and I wrote, another funny perspective, in a country of stagnating overall growth, with the birth rate below the replacement rate, should we not be actively welcoming more young people who have a burning desire to come and build a real life here? I personally think the moral imperative is enough to mandate action even if it did cost us, but in reality, I can see a path to helping being a sound, self-interested economic policy over the right time horizon.
Nice. Very eloquently put. We'll definitely come to discussing what the arguments for accepting refugees are. I mean, they're based on humanitarian, moral, legal, and even economic grounds, as you put there. And we can look at what the arguments are against as well, because those are obviously the ones that have informed the UK government's new policy.
But, racism.
Yeah.
On the one hand, economic migrants. On the other hand, they're brown. Sorry, that's not my view. That seems to be the government's view.
In quotes. So, intro to Gary Lineker and who he is and what's going on. He's a UK household name, but for our more international audience, he is a retired English professional footballer. He used to play as a striker. He comes from Leicester, which is where he started his footballing career, but he went on to play for the likes of Everton, Barcelona, Spurs, and even a Japanese team.
He was a genuine international big football star, played for the national team. But more recently, even more importantly, this will be relatable to our American audience, the English equivalent of Monday Night Football. And it is literally, it's copied, I think, from NFL format Monday Night Football. The show where we play the highlights from the weekend on Monday night, we call it Match of the Day.
Our Saturday night show, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I never watched it.
I'm pretty sure. I have no idea. I would assume Match of the Day came before.
No, they do it after the matches, though.
No. So Match of the Day is a big, it's a UK institution, but it's Saturday night or Sunday night, and it's the roundup of the weekend's games.
I thought it was a Monday. Anyway, the format is very similar to Monday Night Football. They play the highlights and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and they do their analysis.
Gary will analyze and
much like presenters. Much like the NBA and NFL equivalents, they tend to have very famous ex-players. Mm-hmm. So in this context, Gary Lineker is like the equivalent of Shaquille O'Neal or Charles Barkley.
And he's done this since 1999. So he's been there for over 20 years. I think another relevant bit of context is
for most people our age, he's more famous for the show than for playing football.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I never grew up watching him play football, but I've grown up watching him present Match of the Day. He's also the BBC's highest paid presenter.
They're kind of a semi-public entity, so all the salaries get released. What was it? It's like multi-millions.
I actually don't know how much he earns. I think it's got to be a public record.
It's got to be 5 to 10 million a year.
Yeah, it's definitely in the millions.
And this is for a show that's once a week.
Yeah. But like you say, I mean, he does do other sort of commentary and he'll analyze games and whatever.
He's also
playing the World Cup. He'll be there.
He's a pundit. Yeah, like all the equivalents in the other sports. His brother is also a professional creep.
What is that?
Do you not know about this? His brother is just Google Gary Lineker brother creep. He just is like an influencery type who just completely trades off being Gary Lineker's brother.
I see.
And like, I remember he had like some weird, sorry, I'm making accusations without even remembering the context here. He had like a weird list of like requirements for girls he date, and all he dates girls much younger than him and all that.
Right.
I'm confident enough, just Google Gary. In fact, I'll do it now.
Okay.
Hot take session.
It is a hot take session after all. So why not throw out these allegations in the mix?
Here we go. Gary's brother Wayne, 58, branded a creep for revealing bizarre criteria for his future girlfriend, which includes giving up her career, being able to cook, and loving R&B. He split from his ex-fiance, who was 31 years his junior. It's all pictures of him and young women in Ibiza.
Oh no, was she too old for him?
I don't know. Wow, there's like this whole thing he posted on Instagram. You'll need to spend the summer in Ibiza, the winter in Dubai, with 2 weeks in UK for Christmas. You can't have kids.
Let's get back on track here. So,
no, Jake, I don't want to talk about refugees. I want to talk about Gary Lineker's brother.
Forget about Wayne Lineker for a second. Gary Lineker got into a lot of trouble recently, although the situation is now resolved. And we'll quickly run you through why. So, Suella Braverman, the UK
sound like a criminal.
Well, Suella Deville.
Yeah.
Like a cartoon villain.
Yeah.
She put out a video that got a lot of attention recently in the news, and the sum of it was introducing the UK's new migration bill, which was basically labeled Stop the Boats.
This is in reference to boats that are trying to cross the channel.
Exactly.
Illegally. The English Channel from France.
You had an interpretation of this, I think, succinctly, was just if people can't make it to sort of to the shores of the UK to claim asylum, then that avoids the legal imperative, right?
Yeah, it's a weird, we'll talk about like how asylum seeking and refugee status works, but basically like if they stop you before you get here, you're just illegal, but as soon as you get here, they have to help you. It's such a weird kind of like moral legal kind of loophole where it's like, well, if we stop the boats, then they never become refugees legally.
And what's interesting is the narrative sort of suggested around the bill is that there's this huge influx of people. I mean, they were throwing out statistics in the video about how many people were making the crossing and pushing forward the story that the UK is just overwhelmed. And to this, Gary replied, "Good heavens, this is beyond awful." He did this in a tweet. "There is no huge influx. We take far fewer refugees than other major European countries. This is just an immeasurably cruel policy directed at the most vulnerable people in language that is not dissimilar to that used by Germany in the 1930s. And I'm out of order. Rhetorical question mark." The rhetorical question mark was obviously me annotating the question mark. He put this out and caused uproar. The government replied they were disappointed to see this kind of rhetoric from someone whose salary is paid by the license fee. They kind of...
Which, okay, this is a whole other problem.
Right, well, they put pressure then on the BBC to deal with it.
Oh, wait. Two things. One, I got the stats up. So for context, Germany takes, in 2021, took about 130 million. France took about 130,000. France took about 100,000. And the UK took 45,000. And then the other one is, you said, for someone who's paid by the license fee. So this might be novel to Americans. In the UK, technically, if you have a TV and you watch terrestrial TV, you know, cable TV, you are obliged to pay for a license. And these fees go to the BBC. And increasingly, more and more people are like, look, the BBC isn't politically neutral. We don't want effectively a tax to fund a media organization where we don't have control over the biases it has and stuff.
And you have so many streaming services already, right?
And that's the other thing. Like, no one watches TV anymore. So why the hell should I pay for this? It's funny that the government would name something, would use, like, as a weapon, something that is an unpopular government policy.
Right, exactly. The Lineker thing obviously then gets worse. So a few days later, you've got the MP, Penny Mordaunt, Tory MP, accusing
Tory
Labour.
Tory is like the right-wing Conservative Party.
From the Conservative Party, you're in power. She's accusing Labour of borrowing from Gary Lineker's playbook. And I think her exact words are, Labour are borrowing from Gary Lineker's playbook. Labour are a party of goal hangers and left-wing strikers. That doesn't work in politics. This country needs centre-forwards. Gary then cheekily replies, thank you for mentioning me and your clumsy analogy. I'm just happy to have been better in the six-yard box than you are at the dispatch box. So he's getting, there's a tension. It's sort of spiraling a little bit. The situation gets worse. The BBC announced that Lineker is going to be suspended and he's not going to present Match of the Day on Saturday. Everything then kind of centered around what is going to happen on Saturday with this program.
So of course, you know, the refugees is one thing, but him not being on the football channel.
It's amazing how stuff like this, obviously, yeah, it did generate more attention than the underlying bill, which is in many ways the more important thing. But I suppose indirectly is drawing attention to it. But yeah, in solidarity with the fact that Gary was suspended, all his co-presenters stepped back, and then everyone who would have been in position to replace them said no, you know, out of solidarity. We won't
PR present. Nightmare, right?
Exactly. And then
I don't like refugees.
Eventually the show airs with no presenters. They just show the highlights. There's no commentary. So it's a bit of a weird dead episode. And the BBC's director, I can't remember what his title is, but like BBC Director General Tim Davey flies back from wherever he is. I don't know what he's done abroad. Discusses it with Gary.
He's allowed to be on holiday, mate.
Not with the license fees that we're paying.
Not with the license fees, Jesus Christ.
But no, he flies back and they have this sort of emergency talk and everything's resolved. And Gary actually doesn't have to apologize for what he said. So
to be fair, this is the point of the hot take episode. Rightfully so.
I think so.
Sometimes it's a bit lazy to invoke Nazism. It's like the ultimate, like every argument falls back to Nazis. He's right that like, even if you support stopping the boats, which I happen not to, we'll discuss that a bit more. Like the use of dehumanizing language has this profound impact on the way that we start to think about these people and deal with these people. It was the same with the Brexit thing where they were having these pictures of like lines of people coming from Turkey, which was in that case totally fictitious. Like, don't get me wrong, there are people trying to come across on boats. Is the government maybe overplaying or overstating how terrible the issue is? To be honest with you, I haven't followed it closely enough to make a statement like that, but it's definitely happening to some extent. But yeah, to talk about these people as something other than humans in really desperate situations in need of help in a dehumanizing way, yeah, that kind of is how the Germans were treating the Jews.
Exactly. And there's two things to be discussed here. There's the bill itself and what Gary was saying and what you're just saying and where we stand on sort of the approach to migrants. And then there's also the BBC neutrality element of the argument.
Can you say the thing about whoever it was? They were like, what?
Yeah, well, this is true. So Ella Braverman, the Home Secretary, she personally reacted to Gary's initial tweet saying she was really offended because her husband was Jewish. This is why she so reacted badly in the first case.
It's genuinely the equivalent of like, yeah, well, I have a black friend, so...
So I'm not racist.
Yeah, so I'm not racist.
Yeah. Which one do you want to tackle first? Do you want to talk refugee policy or do you want to talk BBC neutrality?
Refugee policy.
So this is the thing. You've said this already, but they're making two big arguments around why we shouldn't accept refugees. And in theory, there are sort of three categories of arguments they could make. The big one is the economic one. They're just saying it's a drain on the UK's resources, particularly things like housing, healthcare. They throw out a stat about spending $7 million a night on hotels for asylum seekers, as if that's just like, you know, unsustainable, unaffordable, as if that's the only option.
I mean, the alternative is you could make a better housing policy around that. Granted, that's hard. There's a shortage of housing. But again, also one of those things where it's like, we're spending X money on the NHS. And it's like, well, you're not throwing the money into a pit. You're also funding local businesses with that, right? You're paying $7 million to hotels in the UK. It doesn't go into a void.
And it's interesting, there are two other themes of argument that they could make, which they don't seem to be here, although you have heard them before in the Brexit debates and other times. So one is security concerns, which is that accepting more refugees could pose a security risk because terrorists or other criminals could exploit the system to enter the UK. And then cultural concerns, which is that accepting refugees could lead to social tension in the UK. Refugees may have different cultural values or customs. Accepting large numbers of them could lead to a disintegration of social cohesion, and they might not integrate. They'll end up in isolated, marginalized societies. So that would also in its own way be a bad thing.
And there was a legal part to it, right?
Well, the legal argument is an argument for rather than against.
Right,
these are the arguments against accepting refugees. And really, the UK government is playing the economic
card. So basically, short-term economic. To be fair, it's also a bunch of bureaucratic hassle, right? I think the things that I would say is like short-term economic, my hot takes are kind of fair, but stupid. It's a stupid argument in the short term. Well, I kind of get it because we're in an economic crisis, etc. But like, one, doesn't matter. Moral imperative, like these are people who are fleeing more often than not. For those who I don't know enough about, to be fair, probably should have looked into it, but like for
it's people, a hot take episode, you're
allowed yeah, to. for people who are not in genuine kind of like fleeing dangerous country situations and stuff like that, like I'm fairly sure the asylum system would filter them back to wherever they're supposed to go, right? Like you can't just immigrate here illegally. Like we're talking about asylum seekers and refugees, right? Like you don't cross the channel having a passport from Ecuador and claim asylum, you know, with no reason, right? These are people who have a reason to claim these things.
Yeah. It's not the first time the UK government's done something unpopular like this, because last year, you may remember, they introduced their Rwanda policy, which was that anyone who was deemed to be unworthy of actually claiming asylum would be sent to Rwanda to complete their asylum.
Yeah, this was so ridiculous. It's so cruel, it's almost funny. They were just going to send people from wherever they came from to a country in Africa to just hang out until they sorted their asylum stuff. Like
it's this weird sort of snakes and ladders effect of like, yeah, yeah. It's like you've got here, oh no.
I mean, it would be like if America was just like, yeah, we're just gonna ship people to Guatemala until we work out what to do with them.
Yeah.
I mean, Australia kind of does do that. Australia has like some islands where they send people to.
Really,
yeah, they do. It's big controversial issue.
Australia is the one that the UK often cites actually as a kind of example.
Why does everyone cite Australia? Australia is like, no, don't do that. Like Australia is super racist. Like stop citing Australia. Australia listed indigenous people as like flora and fauna until like the 70s or 80s or something.
Really? Yeah. Oh my God. But yeah, these are, you know, the UK, I think it's received condemnation for these kind of things before. Gary, I think, is absolutely right to have sort of used his platform and his fame to draw attention to this again, because what they've missed with this policy, briefly, the arguments why we should accept refugees, and you said this already in your introduction, Ant, but again, there are three themes here. There's the economic arguments, which you made quite clearly. There's the humanitarian argument, which I think is the strongest one, which is just that many people would think that we have a moral obligation as a more developed and prosperous nation to help and support people who are fleeing,
which is true,
from persecution, conflict, or other human rights abuses.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I'd say that's true.
And then thirdly, there's the legal argument, which is
so we didn't address on the other side, though, the cultural argument.
No, we didn't, that's true. Although it wasn't one that they were playing strongly as a card for.
Can I just quickly say,
of course,
nonsense. The UK's colonized half the world. The UK's had waves of immigrants from loads of other places, mostly places we colonized. You know, a lot of these immigrants are coming from places that have been destabilized either directly because of us or indirectly because of us, places like Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is nonsense. And it's like, it's this weird thing where like, we keep, you know, in a healthy society, I generally would say, like, culture evolves and that involves new people coming often. And yet there's this constant kind of like, well, we need to keep it where it is. And it's like, well, the way we like it now is a result of change, right? Like, you think about the waves of South Asian immigrants, you know, who've completely changed the landscape in many places around the UK. And, you know, for the better, like, it's part of what we now think of as English culture. Caribbean people, you know, the Windrush generation.
Yeah.
Although they're also trying to kick some of the people who have never been to Jamaica, trying to kick them back. So like, what are you doing?
Exile these people. But it's true, that forms, that's now itself like a sort of recognized British cultural identity, right?
Yeah. So it's so silly that we like then have this idea like, no, now we're going to freeze it in amber. But sorry, you were talking about some of the arguments on the other side. Let's go.
Yeah, the final argument in favor, we talked about economic stuff.
Wait, just quickly review them.
Economic arguments, humanitarian arguments, and then legal arguments.
Legal, okay, in favor.
The legal obligation is that under international law, we have a duty to protect refugees and provide them with access to asylum procedures.
This is a funny one because, like I said, the whole point of the Stop the Boats thing is if they don't get to the UK, you're not doing that. You're just stopping them from being in a position to
claim. Actually right. And that's the really interesting thing about this, isn't it?
Do it from abroad, which is much harder and slower.
This is an interesting thing. If you did want to weigh up the sort of scales of both these things, you've got economic arguments for and against. And although personally, I'd lean towards the economic arguments in favor of the way you laid them out at the beginning, you could ultimately be like, well, those balance. The humanitarian argument, I think, is a really strong one. I don't really...
I mean, I feel like the humanitarian argument that wins. The humanitarian argument surely is strong enough that...
The others are kind of details.
I get that policy is a multifaceted thing, but in reality, like, the rest of it doesn't really matter. We should do it because...
It's
the right thing to do. These people are in desperate, desperate need. Like, and that's the main reason most countries do take refugees. There's not someone somewhere in the government doing a cost-benefit analysis. Actually, I say that there probably is. The real reason that you should take refugees is because it is the right thing to do.
Agreed. Which makes the legal argument interesting because that's basically enshrining in law this moral imperative. It's the
legal stuff is more about how you do it than why you do it.
Yeah, but you're right because... As you say, this whole sort of theme of stop the boats basically means that the legal argument doesn't stand. So it is just the loophole, effectively.
Yeah, because, they're also talking about changing the law so that it's quicker and easier to send some people back. Mm-hmm. But I haven't read it specifically enough.
Yeah, as you say, it's a hot take episode.
Hot take.
I have all the details. But that's the discussion about refugees. And of course, I'd say this is going to be a hot take where we both agree the arguments in favor are much stronger. And therefore, I think Gary's comments were totally fair in terms of content. However, one element of the Gary debate, which we now need to discuss, is, of course, the use of his position in BBC neutrality. And that's where, I mean, an awful lot of people agreed with Gary, but this is the catch, is that BBC has strict, although strict but vague, rules about this. So Gary signed a five-year deal with the BBC in 2020, under which he agreed to adhere to their updated impartiality rules. The rules for news and current affair journalists are really strict, and basically their personal accounts are treated as if they're part of the BBC's output. So anything you say is seen to be representing the BBC, and if you're therefore...
That's firstly something I disagree with.
Well, that's just the rules, though.
I know, but I disagree with
that. Fair enough. Lineker is in a slightly grayer area because he works in the sports department, so he does have more freedom in theory to express his own opinion, but he should avoid bringing the BBC into disrepute. And this is where...
He didn't. If anything, he helped them.
I'd agree. This is where you look at, I look at this and I think, you know what, he's laid down a moral marker and said, no, this is unacceptable. I think if anything, he looks like a good ambassador for the BBC. I don't really see why this is a case of being unimpartial when what you're doing is using your platform to speak out against the government policy that you deem inappropriate. I'm actually completely on his side and have been the whole time.
I think on the whole impartiality thing, I understand the intention. It's kind of nonsense in general because... The whole idea of impartial, it's like when people say like without bias or like a fair or neutral perspective, right? There is no such thing as a fair or neutral perspective. There's just perspectives, right? And you might have like a more popular perspective or a on some scale middle of the way perspective. But like, remember, there's tons and tons of different dimensions you need to be in the middle of. We disagree on like how those scales look like and how they intersect between them. Like, this idea that there is like some objective, natural, neutral opinion is nonsense. The only neutral opinion is no opinion. And actually, sometimes even that in practice, not expressing an opinion sometimes, you know, in a world of like tacit consent or with the concept of tacit consent, even that's not neutral sometimes.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Sometimes having no opinion or no answer is itself an answer. Yeah, I think the BBC commitment to neutrality is just like, it's this weird, amorphous, frequently criticized concept that I think is kind of philosophically impossible. But
yeah, I actually feel like on it, like the BBC as a publicly owned, neutral, whatever, blah, blah, blah. I'm not generally for privatizing everything, but I kind of feel like this is a good example of where like them as a public channel, it's a bit of a relic and doesn't make tons of sense.
Why?
Well, for this exact reason, right? If you're going to be publicly funded, you need to be impartial, but it's impossible to be impartial. And on the one hand, it's nice to have like a moderator. But on the other hand, like, yeah, I don't know, free market economist sort of thinking would be like, well, you'll get a range of different opinions expressed by private media companies. And it's kind of the synthesis of this that helps people understand what the kind of common opinion is. The only problem is, in retort to that, you might say, well, no, that's not what happens. People don't have a balanced,
like, news feeds, right?
Yeah, people just
kind of going down.
That's it. People just like go further and further. They're pushed to certain sides. So having like a mutually agreed, like, okay, this is at least kind of middle opinion, is in some way helpful. And to be fair, I think they're true. That if you're not holding them to a ridiculous standard, they do achieve that. Like, it is kind of the middle of the road opinion, I think. To be fair, I don't follow enough, but I think they're often accused of being quite right wing.
Well, their ownership or directors or whatever, there's definitely, they've been accused of sort of funding the Tory party, or I say accused, I mean, that's happened, that's empirically a fact, and therefore...
The BBC or the people
who... people who work there, etc., or like...
However, I thought, well, Jake will know because his partner is a journalist. Is journalism not generally as an industry quite like liberal left-leaning? It's ironically like...
Depends where you write for.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in general, like academia, in general, yeah, there's like academia, you get some of the craziest right-wing people, but in general, it's a liberal left-leaning area. And I feel like journalism is that, but ironically, you don't make money doing that unless you're like very popular in the lib left sort of scene. You end up getting a lot of like lib left people writing for right wing outlets.
That is certainly an impression.
Which is basically your girlfriend.
That's certainly an impression I've had of, yeah, different places.
Sorry if we got you in trouble by outing your political leaning, Leah.
Well, it's an impression I got from her and her friends is that you do have places where actually, yeah, liberal left people are kind of writing what they think right wing people or right-wing views want to see, which is ironic, I suppose. Back to the point about the BBC.
So is the BBC right-wing generally? Does it have a lean right-wing?
Well,
I hear it's like not harsh enough in the Tories.
Is that they, you know, this Lineker thing is an example of their version of neutrality, which you can't speak up against the Tories. And actually, in this case, I think.
Yeah, and actually, it's like, well, the media, like neutrality might mean speaking.
The job of the media in general is to be the fourth pillar of government, right?
Got you. Hold people to account. Not if you, you know, believe Noam Chomsky's view of manufacturing consent is correct. A thought, though. Might this be more a factor of, in the UK, we've had a conservative right-wing government in power for about 10 or 12 years now, which is one of the longest like continuous stretches. The annoying thing for me, it's the same for you, this is pretty much exactly overlapped with the entirety of my voting life. So my vote has not mattered at all for my entire life.
I've not voted into power for the last 12 years.
So my point there is this more a symptom of like the symbiotic relationship between government and media, where like, you know, if you cozy up to government, you're more likely to get the scoop, you're more likely to, you know, if they think that you're going to write favorably about them, they're more likely to talk to you and promote the story that you're putting out there, et cetera, et cetera. Or is it a right-wing leaning within this specific media outlet, which is a government outlet effectively?
I actually have no idea. I couldn't tell you.
Okay. Well, it's something to consider, listener.
It's definitely something to consider. One thing I'd say just to sort of close the BBC point is, and this is one of my favorite phrases lately, I keep using it all the time, I think the fact that perfect neutrality is hard to achieve is, like you said, not a reason not to strive for it in some form or other. You don't want the great to be the enemy of the good. Being my phrase.
I have heard you say that recently. What was the context? You said that to me.
I say it all the time.
it was a Greta Thunberg episode.
It was, actually. I think I used it in that one.
You know what?
Because the BBC is generally quite respected for doing a good job. And where they mess up is like, you know, you'll have debates.
Well, this is an example of the messing up.
yeah, exactly. I'm trying to.
But even then, there's a market correction.
Yeah, there are examples of, I don't know, let's say, is this a good one? Like, sort of vaccinations, would balance be to have an anti-vax versus a sort of pro-vax person? To look at...
Yeah, I mean, the classic example with climate change is...
If
9 out of 10 scientists agree that climate change is real, should you have one person for and one person against?
Yeah, exactly, which I think wouldn't actually be a fair representation of neutrality, because that makes the spectrum look like it's...
I understand your point.
Divided.
I understand your point. So like, maybe, I guess the way that you can do it is aim for neutrality, but, you know, try and address the ways that you're not perfect and openly have that discussion, which, I don't know, it's hard as a media outlet to undo your credibility. On the good enemy, the great...
No,
I don't know.
Great,
on
the one, enemy, the good.
Great, the enemy, the good. I understand that, but you also... The fact that you're roughly going in the right way is not a reason to not improve or to not hold yourself to a higher standard. Where you draw those lines is, you know, depends a bit.
I think that's probably not a bad place to wrap up the hot take section of this episode.
We do actually get quite a lot of listeners who write in and say, oh, I'd like for you guys to discuss XYZ, and we don't have time to do full episodes on all of them, but can share some of the stuff here. They might make hot take episodes for those that we find particularly interesting, or you guys say that, let us know you find particularly interesting. We can always pick them up as actual episodes. So a recent one from Katerina Pina, who we've been chatting with a bit on Instagram, around the moral duty of speaking up, or I think a relevant context that people might have heard this recently is anti-racism. When it's not enough to simply be against something, when you need to actively fight something. A low stakes example she gives is a racist uncle at Christmas dinner. You know you're not going to change their mind. You'll annoy the whole family and ruin the meal. Maybe it's not worth speaking up, but do you have a moral responsibility to, because it's the right thing to do?
A very everyday question. Well, yeah. Not literally every day, but it's a very relatable question.
Yes. And then other examples might be, for example, in the workplace, where you may have a responsibility to speak up, and you can see some argument that like this might affect change, but maybe it doesn't suit your own motives that much. Maybe you don't want to piss off your boss by dubbing them in for something that maybe they hadn't meant negatively, or all the way to super high stakes like a journalist in Russia or a victim of assault. And then here's another one. This is basically a bit of a rephrasing of something that I'd mentioned on that episode, but is there a moral duty to call out minor inconsistencies or failures in a movement if it might put in peril the otherwise important and genuine results of the movement?
So like the Greta episode, right?
So yeah, it's in reference to that, I think. So specifically what I was saying there, were like, even if Greta's overall movement is good and I generally agree with her, should we still apply some moral scrutiny and be like, wait, no, but this thing that you said like the problem is like, obviously that's a nuanced opinion and a lot of people can't handle nuance.
It's so an interesting one though, because it is, as you say, she puts it really well with like, you don't want that to imperil the whole movement. So when you call out something like that as an inconsistency,
yeah,
you're not saying everything she stands for is worthless, but you are saying this particular aspect was incorrect, but that has the risk of being interpreted in a way.
Yeah, sometimes it's like,
really slam the brakes.
It's actually like a consequentialism thing where it's like, is the negative impact on this movement, just because people can't absorb nuance, worth the, you know, making sure, like I was saying in that episode, people aren't doing the right thing for the wrong reasons? Because not to be Gary Lineker here, but like, that's how people ended up supporting the Nazis, right? You're kind of going along, you're not really assessing things properly, you're doing the right thing for the wrong reasons, and suddenly like, you can't really talk people out of it because they're no longer using reason as the way that they are coming to their decisions for things. Other examples, this is from Jordan, is the name on their account. Do we moralize and should we moralize health? Is being unhealthy immoral? If you're eating a ton of fast food, are you being immoral? Or, you know, is that kind of your choice?
This is definitely an episode we should come to, because there's so many good studies on this. And the one that always makes me laugh when we talk about
the smoking one,
the smoking company actually argued that they were benefiting public health because people were dying younger and therefore not becoming a drain on the state when they grew older. And obviously that didn't land particularly well. But
yes,
funny from a purely economic point of view.
This is funny. Is smoking immoral because it kind of hurts other people too? Brackets, secondhand smoking. French is a shit language. Other people get very upset when you get lung cancer. I really enjoyed that middle bit.
What's the relevance?
French people smoke, I suppose, a lot. And I just love, it's so true that it's the expression I always hear. It's like, France is excellent. Like, the food is amazing. The country is amazing. The only problem is the French.
It's a fun privilege of being British.
Yes.
You get to joke about the French.
Here's another one. Should the government be allowed to create laws that limit portion sizes in schools and restaurants? Kind of similar to the moralizing of health, I think.
Like a sub-question of that.
But yes, those are all good. And then there was another one recently where it was, why do we stigmatize our bodies as animals? You know, why is being naked in public or even having sex in public a stigmatized thing? Which I suppose it's funny because like when you first hear it, it's like, that's ridiculous. But then you think about it a bit more. I mean, for example, this sounds funny, but like if you cough, well, actually, in a post-COVID world, not so much, but I don't know. If you, like, wipe your nose or whatever, no one's particularly bothered by that, right? But why is farting disgusting? Right? Because it smells bad.
There's next to now.
But yeah, I mean, the point is we have a lot of things that are heavily socialized, and actually, like, our negative reactions to them don't need to exist. I personally probably don't have the view that we should all be having sex in public and walking around naked, but I could see that, like, our views around them are, or the way that we would think it's disgusting or negative is socialized. That was a question that recently was mentioned to us.
It's an interesting case of where, morality is maybe based more on your socialization than necessarily being a moral actual undertone to the question, right?
Yeah.
Like, is
relativism.
Maybe. I mean, the fact that we don't all have sex in public, I mean, now it becomes a moral behavior because that's the social norm, and it would be at this point immoral
you'd be
to just start doing it because you'd be offending people. But
it's not particularly gross for people to a hug in public, hold hands, kiss. And I mean, the relevant thing, or I suppose the way to phrase this into a more relatable or family-friendly question would be, free the nip. No, they're genuinely like, you know, why have we so severely sexualized? And even if it is sexualized, what's the problem? Like, we encounter people all day, every day who we find attractive and like, we deal with that without it being a problem, right? Like, why is it, men can be topless. Why is it a problem if women are topless? This is the whole point they're making, because, you know, men topless can be attractive to women. Like, why is this any different? I, for one.
All good questions.
We were clearing a bit of a backlog there, but we encourage you, send something through. We'll look at it in a hot tech question, and then we'll talk about one or two every couple weeks in more depth.
Cool, guys. Well, see you next time.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
Maybe we'll try and post this on a Tuesday just so it can be Hot Take Tuesday.
Hot Take Tuesday. That sounds good. That's got a nice ring to it.
Guys, another thing, please, If you do enjoy the show, if you enjoyed the show and you're listening on Spotify or Apple or whatever, give it a follow. Apple listeners haven't had written reviews on Apple for a while, and it makes us sad. And the other thing is, share the show. We don't do guests. We don't do marketing gimmicks and stuff. So the best way for this to grow is honestly for you to share it. If you think that what we've said has any value, just share it with some friends.
Any value at all.
Literally any.
Thanks for listening, and speak to you next time.
Speak to you next time. Bye, guys.